So with that, I'd like to move to the first item on the agenda, engagement quality review, and I'll turn that over to Greg Skates, who will lead that discussion.
Thank you, Jennifer. As you are aware, soon after the board's creation, the board adopted certain existing standards used by the auditing profession. One such standard was the concurring partner review requirement, which the board continued to apply on a transitional basis to registered firms that were members of the SEC practice section of the AICPA as of April of 2003. Registered accounting firms that were not members of the SEC practice section, those were generally non-U.S. firms and some smaller firms, are not subject to this existing requirement. As part of the board's process of evaluating the existing concurring partner review requirement, the board sought the advice of the Standing Advisory Group on two separate occasions, in June of 2004 and October of 2005. In addition to input received at these SAG meetings, the board considered information on this topic from PCAOB inspections, SEC and PCAOB enforcement cases, and other sources. On February 26th, of last year, of 2008, the board proposed to replace the existing requirement with a new auditing standard entitled Engagement Quality Review. The board received 38 comment letters on this proposal, and in response to the comments, made significant changes to the original proposal. On March 4th of this year, the board reproposed the standard. The comment period for this reproposal ends on April 20th. A transcript of the discussion this morning will be available on our website along with the comment letters that we received. Today we'd like to discuss certain aspects of the proposed standard that generated significant feedback from commenters on the original proposal. In particular, the SAG will discuss questions from the release related to reviewer qualifications, the engagement quality review process, concurring approval of issuance, and documentation of the engagement quality review. So first, let's turn to reviewer qualifications. The board originally proposed to allow the engagement quality reviewer to be a partner or another individual in the firm or an individual outside the firm. In contrast, as described in the release on March 4th, the new proposal would require a reviewer from inside the firm to be a partner or a person in an equivalent position. Like the original proposal, the new proposal would allow a qualified person outside the firm to perform this review. In addition, as under the original proposal, the reviewer must have independence, integrity, and objectivity, and must possess the level of knowledge and competence required to serve as the engagement partner for the same type of engagement. The discussion questions on reviewer qualifications taken from the release are on the slide in front of you. And this is the ones we'd like to talk about first. Is it appropriate to explicitly require a reviewer from within the firm to be a partner or an individual in an equivalent position? Should the standard allow qualified accountants who are not employed by the accounting firm to conduct the review? And then, should the standard prohibit the engagement partner from serving as a reviewer for a period of time following his or her last year as the engagement partner? And then, if so, is 2 years a sufficient time, or should it be extended? So I'd like to go ahead and open up our discussion here on the reviewer qualifications for the engagement quality reviewer.
If you're just for the new members, if you're interested in making comments, we'll try to call on you in order. If you could just please put your name 10 on the side, and we'll get to you.
I'm sorry, Wayne Collins.
Yeah, just thinking on the first one, I think it is appropriate for the reviewer to be a partner, and I would just seek some clarification in terms of what equivalent position means. I assume that if the accounting firm is not organized as a partnership, then we're talking about a name other than a partner, but an equivalent to what a partner would be in a partnership.
Yeah, we explained that in the release. Yes, you are correct, Wayne. That if they're structured like a corporation, then they sometimes referred to as members, and that would be someone in an equivalent position as a partner.
Yeah. And I do think it is appropriate for those that are not employed by the firm, and particularly with respect to smaller accounting firms, they may have a resource issue getting the number of a partner to serve as a concurring reviewer, and it has been the experience for such firms to go outside the firm, perhaps getting an accounting professor, audit professor, or somebody that is very experienced doing these reviews, and I think that's an appropriate objective and requirement of a provision for the standard.
Thank you, Wayne. Hal Schroeder?
I was curious about the second requirement or applicability of hiring somebody from the outside. How do you handle the independence issue? It seems like if you find someone, as just suggested, a professor or someone who develops, I would say, a specialty in being this reviewer, will they become dependent on that stream, and would they tend to shade their views to make sure they have that steady stream of being the reviewer? They may be qualified, but their source of income may make them less than independent.
Good point. Thank you. Thank you, Hal. Galen Hansen?
I would follow up with Wayne's comments. I agree that perhaps some clarification on what equivalent position within the firm means, what maybe a little bit of color on that, if it were. But at the same time, on the other question about the outside reviewer, I think the same standard should apply. I don't know how you have a lesser standard with outside individuals than what you would within the firm. And you know, to follow up with the last comment, I think the independence issue is typically resolved with respect to either that individual's with another registered firm and some sort of independence confirmation that there's independence in fact with that client. On the third question about the prohibition of becoming an engagement quality reviewer after serving as an engagement partner, if you still have years open within the five-year rotation period, I think some break is appropriate. I'm not sure where the 2 years came from or why it was thought that would be appropriate. I would even ask, in the interest of smaller firms that have limited resources, whether a one-year break would be sufficient. I'm not sure, you know, the 2 years is necessary.
Bernard Jarvis?
It's my view also that the engagement quality review is a very important part of the audit and ought to be assigned to a person who is a senior executive in the firm. And that would, in my opinion, be someone at the partner level. And I just addressed the third point. I agree with Galen that perhaps in the case of small firms, 1 year break. I do agree that some break is necessary, and I'd agree that about 1 year would be sufficient.
Other comments on the qualifications of the reviewer? Joe Carcello?
I appreciate the sentiment on the 1 year. The one thing you probably need to think about carefully, though, since your purview is public companies, there's 2 years of balance sheets and 3 years of income statements and cash flow statements in the 10-K. And so if there's a one-year period after someone rolls off being the engagement partner and they come on and they're the engagement quality reviewer, at least some of the financial information and the financial statements that they're going to be reviewing were financial statements that they were responsible for auditing.
Any other comments on the reviewer qualifications? Arnold Schilder.
Thank you, Greg. Just a brief comment. Fully in agreement with what you have done. If I compare it with what the IWSB has done in the quality control standard, we've tried also to define a bit of a general principle, which mentions, as more general principles, sufficient and appropriate technical expertise, experience, and authority, because you can never, let's say, regulate all detailed circumstances. So we thought it was helpful to have a bit of a broader criteria to which against you can judge the more specific criteria. And I would just offer that as a thought that might be helpful in the circumstances.
Thank you, Arnold. If there are no other comments, we can move to the next topic. Let's turn to the engagement quality review process. As described in the release, under the new proposal, like the original proposal, would require evaluation of significant judgments made and conclusions reached by the engagement team and specify certain procedures that the reviewer should always perform. The new proposal provides that the reviewer should perform these procedures through discussions with the engagement team and through the review of documents. Under the original proposal, after performing certain procedures, the reviewer was required to perform additional procedures in higher risk areas of the engagement. This provision is not included in the new proposal because the board believes that the required procedures are sufficient to focus the reviewer on the areas of higher risk. The new proposal describes specific requirements for an engagement quality review of an interim review. These requirements are based on the proposed requirements for an engagement quality review of an audit and are tailored to the different procedures performed in a review of interim financial information. Now let's turn to the questions in the release on the engagement quality review process as on the screen in front of you. Are the descriptions of the scope and extent of engagement quality review procedures contained in the re-proposed standard appropriate? Will the performance of these procedures result in a high-quality engagement quality review? If not, how should these procedures be revised? Are these specifically required procedures appropriately tailored to reflect the difference in scope between an audit and an interim review? And then lastly, do the specifically required procedures sufficiently focus the reviewer on areas of higher risk? Are there other procedures that should be required? I'm going to open up the floor for a discussion of the engagement quality review process itself. Wayne Collins.
One process, part of the process that I'd like to see put in there is some guidance or some principle regarding how the any differences of opinion between the engagement quality reviewer and the engagement partner are worked out.
Okay. Galen Hansen.
I think that resolution process needs to be addressed that Wayne just brought up. The other thing that I think would be helpful is some sort of distinction between materiality with respect to an audit and a 10Q interim review would seem to be would seem to be appropriate in the sense that materiality under audit, and we all struggle with that, and we've had those discussions around this table, but it involves planning and understanding of the system and internal controls, whereas I think there's a little bit different meaning of materiality on interim reviews, and that there doesn't seem to be any kind of distinction with respect to that and how that is addressed. It talks about material modifications in the AU, what is it, 722, and I think if a little bit more was said about that particular distinction, it would be helpful. Randy Fletchall.
Greg, I would just like to comment first to commend the board. I think the revisions that were made from the first version to this version went a long way in clarifying what I think were some concerns about what exactly is the process that the standard is articulating. I think likewise the original version, an audit and interim review were kind of lumped together, and so now I think it's much clearer that those are different service levels and the level of the engagement review is different. Undoubtedly, we will still have a few comments on a few words that we would suggest probably paragraphs 9 and 10, maybe an intro into that section that would give some additional clarification, but I guess I would just say I think this went a long way in solving what we thought were some of the concerns.
Thank you, Randy. Greg Jonas?
I'm a little surprised that the document doesn't give more attention to the issue of timing of the review. In my experience, a key differentiating factor between substantive concurring partner reviews and non-substantive, often the root cause was the concurring partner was in late. And particularly on larger engagements where audits are kind of like aircraft carriers, you don't turn them on a dime, you don't turn them quickly, you got to get a running start. The concurring partner looking at planning shortly after the planning is done, looking at the resolution of major issues as they occur throughout the year, is really an important factor to a quality review. Also, it helps the concurring partner get their head in the game, which is critically important, particularly in complex work. I certainly understand the board's desire not to be too prescriptive about timing. I appreciate that timing, best timing practices differ dramatically from job to job, but I am surprised that it almost walks away from the issue and abdicates any counsel in a standard on what, in my experience, has been mission critical to a quality concurring partner review.
Greg, can I just ask you to expand on what you might think would be appropriate to include, recognizing the standard would be, to be applied but for all public company audits to have an engagement quality review. So you kind of what in your view and the timing would you like to see mentioned, just if you have any more thoughts specifically?
Well, if the document at least talked about the importance of timing, the importance of concurring partners to get in early where desirable, the advantages of doing this, and simply observed that one of the factors that one considers when deciding whether a concurring review was substantive in part relates to the timing. I wasn't thinking more than that.
Thank you.
Liz Fender.
I'm not sure I'm reading it correctly, but I was questioning the differences between the procedures required for an interim review versus an annual review, and I think the wording was trying to make it clear that if you're doing an interim review, you don't have to look at the prior year's disclosures about internal control for the annual review report. And one, is that correct? And two, would you really do that? Would you really review somebody's interims and not take a look at what somebody raised in the prior annual review?
Liz, are you talking about the prior review of a prior quarter, or are you talking about the annual audit?
Yeah, I think the wording says you only have to look at the prior interim information, and so I didn't know if that was meant to say you don't have to look at the prior year's annual audit reports.
Well, the engagement quality viewer would be looking at if he or she's not already familiar with the engagement and what happened in the prior year's audit, because if he or she was new to the engagement, then they would obviously look at prior year's audit and see what the issues were, what the audit issues were, and in carrying out the interim review, they would look at the prior quarter if there's a prior quarter they looked at, then they would look at that to see what the issues are. They want to, because they want to keep current with the issues and know what they are going into that review.
Yeah, I agree with the sentiment. I'm just not sure the words are clear about that. That obviously you do have to familiarize yourself with the engagement, but it, when it was trying to describe the differences between what you're required to do in an interim versus an annual, it sort of said you only have to look at the prior interim.
Okay, we'll look at that, take a and make sure that's clear. Thank you. Doug Anderson.
I had a concern on how the objective is worded and how the procedures in paragraph 10 and paragraph 9 are described. As I read the objective, which I think is a great idea to have a clearly stated objective for the standard in paragraph 2, it seems pretty broad. It looks like we want to make sure that there's a good evaluation of judgment, a good evaluation of conclusions received. As I look at paragraph 10, it talks about in part B that the review should evaluate the risk assessments, the audit responses, meaning the scope of the work. Those all seem pretty broad. As I go back up, though, to paragraph 9, it says you're supposed to do that merely by holding discussions with the engagement team effectively and reviewing documentation. And those, to me, seem to be inconsistent. The objective and what we're trying to get out of this review seems very broad and comprehensive, but then we've limited the procedures. And my concern is that those two things could be considered in conflict, that the external auditing firms will then revert back to what they think the objective is driving, as opposed to what paragraph 9 is saying. So as I look at this, it just seems inconsistent, those two directions in the standard look inconsistent, and either needing more clarification back up in paragraph 2 as to what the objective is, or maybe more clarification in 10B about that.
Well, thank you, Doug. We'll take another look at that, make sure that they are consistent and clear and concise. Bob Dacey.
Thanks, Greg. We, too, appreciate the changes that were made in response to the comments on the earlier draft, but still have some concerns about, at least it's our perception, that some of the other standards, particularly the IAASB, are at a more general principle level than what this would provide in the PCAOB. And again, in this area as well as other areas, just have a concern as to whether or not there's a perception that the general principles stated in some of these other standards are consistent with where you are going or different because of the different terminology that you're using. So we just want to again raise that point, a concern in this area in particular as to whether or not that will create any conflict in application. Thanks.
Hal Schroeder.
Echoing some comments that were made earlier, I am curious myself as to why at least the signing off on the engagement planning portion, it's not encouraged or recommended that it's done concurrent. At the same time, the partner is signed off on it. The reviewing partner should be signing off on the planning before anything substantive is done. Because as I read through the requirements, you don't have any opportunity to make any recommendations or changes. The game's over by the time you get involved. And I would strongly recommend that at least there be two segments to a reviewer's involvement, early in the process and then at the end of the process.
Thank you, Hal. Kurt Schett.
A quick question for those of us not in the profession. I'm curious, how often does the EQR result in a material change, and does the PCAOB, or should it, keep statistics on that so that you have some statistical evidence of how often problems should be found in a particular company's audits?
You can look at some of our inspection reports have cited some findings with respect to the performance or lack of performance, of adequate performance in the engagement quality review, but we don't have any statistics on it. But I'd be interested to hear from the profession, anyone who wants to. Ben Coleman?
Yeah, I'll certainly be brave. That kind of statistic would be very difficult if your objective is a good engagement quality review. I do engagement quality reviews now. And to say, did you catch something, if you're doing it well from the planning through the execution to the final, and you are engaged with the engagement team, you're both independent, but yet you are understanding issues as they arise. So the objective is to avoid looking for the statistic that, you know, you're asking for, because the objective is to get it right before you even, you know, would get into that position, if you're doing your job right, correctly.
Paul Sobel.
Thinking through the 302 disclosure requirements, I do see, and I'm thinking of interim reviews. I think it was covered well for the annual review. There is mention about changes, presumably that's material changes in internal control over financial reporting. I didn't see any specific mention about any frauds that might be identified, committed by management or those involved in the financial reporting process. Is that just considered to be intuitively covered by one of the other items?
Paul, can you explain that? Can you go over that discussion again? I'm not sure I understand what you were.
Okay, if there is an incident of fraud committed by a member of management or those integrally involved in the financial reporting process, it has to be disclosed to the audit committee and the independent outside auditor. I presume even with interim financial statements that might raise questions by the engagement partner, and I wasn't sure how that would be covered then in the EQR in terms of the resolution or conclusions about the impact such a fraud may have on the interim information.
The auditor is clearly under a obligation, a professional obligation. If something comes to their attention, do they have to resolve it? They cannot, have some information before them, and because it has, serious consequences with respect to not only the interim financial statements but also the annual, so they have to resolve any particular issue that might be a fraud indicator.
I understand that, and I guess my question was, as I say, it may be, subsumed in one of these bullet points. Is how does the concurring partner get comfortable with the conclusions of the engagement team with regards to that resolution?
Well, the engagement quality reviewer would have to use, his or her professional judgment, and that's what that individual's duty is to challenge what the team has done, and so they would. He or she would be challenging the team's conclusion on any matter, whether it's a matter that you brought up or any other matter, any audit or accounting issue that they're confronted with. That person is charged with that and has that obligation to make sure that they are concurring with the resolution. Because if they're not, then they need to have a further discussion. They may have to, he or she may have to have additional evidence before he or she concurs.
Yeah, I understand that, so I'm either way off base or not making myself clear. I understand what the process should be. The interim procedures are silent with regards to that, so what I'm hearing you saying is that that would just go along with any of the other judgments, material judgments that are made, and doesn't need to be specifically identified as something that should be on the radar screen of the concurring partner, because again, material changes in internal control are mentioned as one of the items, but fraud is not.
Okay, we'll take another look at that.
Paul, I see fraud mentioned in paragraph 15 regarding interim. I don't know, it's one of the under 15A. Engagement quality reviewer should evaluate the nature of identified risks and material misstatement due to fraud. Does that?
It may. I saw that particular point, and to me that was more forward-looking. What are the risks? What are the potentials? And I was referring to something that was known and identified.
Gary Kabur.
Thank you. This question I thought of when Kurt had raised this question about tracking statistics, if you will, when the engagement reviewer overrules the quality reviewer overrules the engagement partner. The question, did the board consider, or should you consider if you didn't, if there really is a significant override by the concurring partner and a decision has changed, whether it's audit scope or accounting or disclosure decisions, should there be a requirement for communication with the audit committee or the audit, at least the audit committee chairman of that event? Again, I appreciate a lot of this stuff. You know, you'll eventually agree and eventually you'll get the evidence, but there's going to be times, presumably, when, in fact, the engaging team is overruled on something that's important. And from a client service point of view, should there be a requirement for at least the audit committee or the audit committee chairman to be advised of that? I don't know if that's a I don't know if he considered it and rejected it. I'm not even suggesting that should be the answer, but I think it should be considered.
So any instance, then, you're saying, in which the engagement team has arrived at a conclusion and then the engagement quality reviewer would disagree, and then then the ultimate conclusion is in the favor of what the way the engagement quality reviewer wanted to go. And so he or she overrides what the engagement team did.
Yes, correct. And presumably anything they would override them on is on something material to the engagement, whether it's on the audit scope or an accounting conclusion, because this is supposed to be risk-focused. And there, and again, I'm not saying that should be the answer. They advise the audit committee or audit committee chair. I'm just saying, asking, did you consider it? And if you didn't, maybe you could before you finalize it.
Would anyone else like to weigh in on that word? Yes.
It's Galen.
Galen Hansen.
I would be very cautious about using the word override. I think ultimately the engagement partner has to be responsible for the opinion that is issued. He's the final person on the line there. But that doesn't mean to say that engagement quality reviewer, the concurring reviewer, doesn't take that further to the firm's quality control partner, to the director of audit services, whatever the structure is within that firm, to try to get resolution. But I think that resolution aspect is a little bit lacking in the standard. But I'm a little bit antsy about this idea that one person can override another person in its entirety.
Thank you, Galen, and thank you, Gary. Wayne Collins?
On that point, I would also be cautious, and even if the word override is not used, and it's a different word, like maybe if it's a disagreement and the engagement quality reviewer's position is the ultimate position, then you'd have to get involved with the defining disagreements again, which is now in the literature between the issuer and the audit firm. And there's a whole different reason for that in terms of the pressure that may be put to bear, which I don't think exists on the engagement team. I'd also be concerned about, in terms of considering this, what that would do to the mindset of the engagement partner in helping to resolve this disagreement. It may make the engagement partner more obstinate in terms of the resolution.
Jim Cox? Oh, I'm sorry, Jamie Miller, sorry.
I think Gary's point is a good one. And it's really a question to me as to how the governance structure works between the auditor and the preparer. I think the key question is how to determine what would get communicated. And I think perhaps one way to think about it would be to consider whether audit committee communication would be required in situations where a formal resolution process had to be invoked to resolve the disagreement, as opposed to those matters that are resolved in the normal course, you know, through additional audit procedures or additional discussion between the concurring review partner and the audit partner. But I think it is something that ought to receive some level of debate.
Thank you, Jamie. Jim Cox?
I'm sort of struck by the opacity of the second paragraph, which states the objective, and I think if we had less opacity, we would deal with a lot of questions which were started off by Harold's comment about what we really want to have happen here. You can think of a wide range of objectives that could be served within this language, and I think we ought to specify which one of it is we want. One would be make this year's audit better. Another one would be make next year's audit better. A third one could possibly be an internal evaluation of your own staff doing this. A fourth one could be external evaluation of, by the audit committee. I mean, what exactly is the objective of the external quality review? I think if you come to grips with that, many of these questions are on this session would shake out from that. But currently, I think that, again, just to repeat myself here, I'm struck by what I perceive as the opacity of the second paragraph stating what the objectives are. I think it's fairly it's too generalized to be very helpful to somebody who's going to have to govern their conduct as an external reviewer or what to make of the external review going forward.
Thank you, Jim. Joe Carcello.
As some of you know, I've spent a lot of time over the years working with accounting and auditing enforcement releases. And one of the things we've seen in some of those, certainly not the majority, but in some situations where obviously there's ultimately a fraud, and people lower on the engagement team had come across issues that were problematic and were dissuaded from being overly concerned about those issues by people higher on the engagement team. And so my concern ties into paragraph 9, where the last sentence in that paragraph talks about holding discussions with the person with overall responsibility for the engagement, holding discussions with other members of the engagement team as necessary. I guess I would encourage the board to at least think about eliminating the words as necessary. In today's world, with the ubiquity of cell phones, you would not have to have this discussion face-to-face. By the time the second partner review is happening, often members of the engagement team are on to the next job. But you could easily pick up a cell phone and just touch base with everybody on the engagement team to just make sure there wasn't an issue that really troubled them, that they maybe were dissuaded from pushing too hard by others higher up in the chain.
Thank you, Joe. Bob Dacey?
I just wanted to add a point. In terms of our government auditing standards, we wanted to clarify in our latest release that, in fact, the firm ought to have procedures in evaluating or monitoring the quality review process, both in terms of identifying any systemic issues that were identified through quality reviews, as well as where the quality review function is being carried out properly in terms of a monitoring procedure. So just offer that in terms of what we've also addressed to deal with the issues of differences and whether or not things caught in a quality review, how they were dealt with, and again, whether that's a systemic issue in the firm.
Greg Jones.
Greg, I'm about to betray my ignorance, so apologies in advance. Does the new quality control requirement apply to review of work supporting the 404 report on internal control?
Yes.
And that is quite a change in practice relative to current practice for concurring partner reviewers?
No. They currently perform that review of the internal control as well as the audit financial statements.
Is it worth making crystal clear in the final document that if the auditor has an integrated audit, that these requirements apply to that 404 work as well, or was I the only person in the room who was left wondering whether it does or doesn't?
Well, I'll go back and look at it again. I thought it was clear, but we'll make sure it is.
It could be my fault. That could be my fault. Thank you.
Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up on Kurt's question earlier and Professor Cox's comments about the objective. In connection with the PCOB's inspection process, have you identified any issues or concerns regarding the EQR process, and can you tell me what two or three of the main issues or concerns were?
But one of the issues is apparent when you look at some of the inspection reports. The question that presents itself is, you know, once you see the deficiencies that have been identified, then you obviously you ask yourself, you know, why didn't the engagement quality reviewer detect some of these deficiencies? I mean, that's paramount with not all the inspection findings, but some of them you'll see that, and we make that clear in some of the reports that. Another issue that comes up is the documentation of the engagement quality review process. It's we have noted that in the reports that it's not sufficient to indicate what the person did and what the person reviewed and what, you know, what conclusion they arrived at, because it's hard to tell what they actually, if they did anything at all. So those are just a couple of findings I would note. Any other comments on the engagement? Yes, Tom?
I've just given some more thought to the question about whether there should be a requirement for communication to the audit committee if there's disagreements or, again, I understand the word override is probably a little inflammatory, but for lack of a better word right now, I just think you need to really consider what the objective of that communication would be. Because as I think more about it, if an auditor in a firm is carrying out the work outlined in the standards such that the reviewing individual can issue the concurring report, then from an audit committee standpoint, the audit committee should be satisfied that the work was done and not be concerned about the inner workings within the audit firm that led to that conclusion. Not any different than for a preparer, if there are debates and dialogues within a company as it's preparing its financial statements. I just think to the extent the board considers a requirement there, you'd be very explicit as to what the objective would be, because otherwise I think you could get into a very inefficient process and a very slippery slope there in terms of what's coming back to the audit committee.
Galen Hansen?
Just following up a little bit on that, in that respect, I wonder to what extent the board considered the interaction of the concurring reviewer with the client itself. And this has come up from time to time. Do they have the same level of discussion access as the engagement partner? Do they meet as regularly? Do they meet in person? Do they call independently? To what level is that independence of the concurring reviewer? I've seen this done both ways, where the firm wants as much insulation and independence as possible of the reviewer, and others that say, well, if they know the client better, they'll understand where they're coming from and so forth. But to what extent was that considered?
We did have some discussions of that, particularly with respect to the for the engagement quality reviewer to maintain his or her objectivity. And one of the issues obviously has to do with when you do have some accounting and auditing issues or contentious issues that come up. But most importantly here is that the engagement team has identified the issue, they have gathered the evidence, and they've come to a conclusion. And at that time, then the engagement quality review would be appropriate for him or her to step in and take a look at it. But most importantly here is that the engagement quality reviewer cannot be a part of the initial process of gathering the facts and gathering the evidence. That's not their job, and they need to stay outside and look in when the issue has been when the team has come to an initial conclusion. Then it's appropriate for that person to come in and step in and take a look at it. So, you know, the objectivity here is very important, because this person is not going to fill the shoes of the engagement partner. And so it's very important. It was very important to the staff when we were developing and drafting the standard to make sure that this person stays outside and looks in and maintains that objectivity.
Galen, is just to kind of follow up, I'd be interested in if you have any observation, you know, experiences at your firm or other firms kind of regarding the engagement quality reviewers' communications with the client, or preparers have any observations on how things are handled, that experience, and how that's been helpful or not helpful.
I think some level of insular, you know, or compartmentalization of that individual makes some sense to at least consider that. And we kind of do that within our firm. We don't want that individual calling the CFO and having these discussions independently. We think that should go through the engagement partner, except for when they're involved in, say, an audit committee meeting.
Thank you, Galen. Sam Ranzella?
Well, having listened to the better part of the last 20 minutes, just a couple of observations. One, I think it's important that we keep in mind the objective, and then I understand some think that the standard could be improved, and I don't know that I disagree with that, but the objective here is to improve audit quality and improve financial reporting. And having, I hear sort of a sentiment around turning the engagement quality control reviewer into another policeman where statistics are kept on what they found or communications made to the audit committee about where they overrode somebody. I don't think that's actually going to improve the situation. From the perspective that the engagement quality review is just one element of the firm's overall system of quality control, and there are plenty of policemen at the firms with respect to internal inspections and other parts of the quality control system where there is a vetting and a quote a second guessing of that engagement partner. And I think this role should be more in line with getting it right the first time, improving the quality of the audit and that client's financial reporting and communication to investors. So I think it's a balancing act. I caution you against turning this role more into a policeman than will be appropriate.
Thank you, Sam. Any other comments on the engagement quality review process?
You know, I do want to follow up on, I guess, Sam and Galen's point. I do think you need to strike the right balance between objectivity and independence that you do already have in the standard. But to do engagement quality, to get it right the first time, as Sam just said, there does need to be a certain level of interaction to make sure that you have a deep enough understanding of what those critical decisions and issues are. And if you go too far away, as I think that was just suggested, perhaps you cannot get it right the first time, and that's the objective.
Thank you, Vin. Larry Salva?
Thanks. 2 points. I guess on the interaction with the concurring partner between the concurring partner and the client interaction, I think, you know, the firms may take different approaches and, you know, at times may have taken different approaches as to how much exposure concurring partners were given to clients. I think that can really be left up to them, you know, in terms of what works best. My current experience is that I do with the firm that I'm working with now, there was a point in time that I knew the name of the concurring partner but had no interaction with the concurring partner at all. And more recently, I've had some interaction but limited. And, you know, I don't think engagement quality has suffered in either of those cases. You know, it's an internal working for the firm in terms of what works best for them. The other point I'd make is in terms of communication with the audit committee, if that is considered by the board, I think it should stay out of this standard. There's a whole slew of things that should get communicated to audit committees, and I think about the audit committee
committee communication that I have in terms of kind of a standard question from my audit committee chair is what close calls may have been debated within our disclosure committee, our internal management committee that discusses issues and resolution. And if the audit committee chair is so inclined to ask the engagement partner or the engagement team, were there issues that were resolved through involvement of the engagement quality reviewer that would have been resolved differently had that review not occurred, fine, let the audit committee chair, you know, be interested in that, or put that into the mix of all of the communications that the auditor should have with the audit committee. But I think it should stay out of the specific standard. It shouldn't be called out as a requirement here.
Okay. Thank you, Larry. Any other comments on this particular topic, on the engagement quality review process? Okay, let's turn to the next topic. The concurring approval of issuance. The original proposal provided that the reviewer must not provide concurring approval of issuance if he or she knows or should know, based upon the requirements of the standard, of certain engagement deficiencies. In response to concerns expressed by commenters, the board revised this provision so that it relies instead on the auditor's existing duty to exercise due professional care rather than using the phrase knows or should know based on the requirements of the standard. Like the formulation in the original proposal, the revised provision makes clear that a reviewer cannot evade responsibility because as a result of an inadequate review, he or she did not discover a problem that a reasonably careful and diligent review, a review formed with due professional care, would have revealed. For our discussion this morning, let's discuss the questions from the release that addressed concurring approval of issuance. In front of you on the screen is the standard for the engagement quality reviewer's concurring approval of issuance appropriately described in the reproposed standard. Is the first condition appropriately tailored to reflect the difference in scope between an audit and an interim review? Jim Schneer.
Thank you. We viewed the removal of know and should know as a positive step, but are a little bit confused by the fact that in the discussion in the forepart of the standard, they define due professional care as the same as know or should know. So it seemed to me that while in one instance they changed the language, they made it clear that they thought the standard was still the same, and I don't think that addresses the concerns that we and others have expressed around that. The second point I would make is it seems odd to me that a individual auditing standard would specifically point out a requirement for due professional care when there is an overall standard, auditing standard that deals with due professional care, which applies to all standards. And so it seems very odd to me that we would have a separate standard, which is then, if you want to call it, somewhat defined in the forepart of the standard.
Other comments? Gary?
Picking up where Jim was just talking, looking at the way at least I read, whether it's auditing releases or accounting standards, you know, there's the standard. And then there's the backup material, in this case, the release, you know, the basis of conclusions and FASBs. And, you know, so usually the standards are pretty clear in what they say, accounting or auditing or whatever. Then you go, what do you mean? And you tend to go to the releases and the issuing cover memos and stuff. And where you get a little bit more free form in the words. And, I mean, I found, you know, over 25 years or so is those are often more useful in terms of communicating intent than the final standard itself. So I can empathize where what Jim is saying with, and, you know, as a preparer, it doesn't matter all that much to me. You know, the preparers, I think, when they commented, worried about, does this become a second audit? I think you're trying to address that, but I can see where they would read that there's a conflict between the release and the standard. Maybe we're reading it wrong, maybe it's unintentional, maybe it's just a draft choice of words and drafting. But seriously, the covering documents, basic conclusion stuff, get read very heavily, you know, in any assessment or interpretation of standards.
Other comments on concurring approval of issuance? Okay.
Craig, I think it's a great idea. I think it should happen, so.
So you're supportive of it? This is an area we did receive a lot of comments, so interested in, you know, in views and in what we've done. So, Galen, I thought I heard you say...
I think it all ties back into the timeliness that we've had a prior discussion about, whether they're involved or whether this review is taking some... It's being wrapped up and there's points that are open after the filing's been made. I just can't imagine that there wouldn't be some level of formal sign-off on the concurring review, and after the fact doesn't do anybody any good. Unless you're talking about next year's audit, Jim.
Ben Coleman.
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate, and you know, you don't want to repeat, but I also don't want the silence in this room to make the point that Jim and Gary have just made, that it's not a significant point. I mean, I think that the standard from a year ago has been significantly improved, as Randy said, and really appreciate that. But by far, this was the biggest issue with respect to the known or should have known. And it seems it's been taken out of the standard, but yet used as a synonym to due professional care. There is another standard that's out there on due professional care. I think we know what it is. And then to have something in there that basically called almost redefines due professional care to be known or should have known, I really question whether or not you addressed the issue. And it's now done in a way, as Gary pointed out, it's in the back somewhere. I'm not sure it was a drafting error. Is that what we are saying or not? And I'm a little bit concerned, did we address it or not? I think we all felt like we did, but yet when you really read it, the answer is maybe we didn't. And I think it does need to be addressed, as was discussed many, many times with the unintended consequences if you were to go in that direction. There's a real concern around it.
Doug Anderson?
And not to pile on, but just emphasize a part that I was trying to make earlier. This whole issue of known or should have known, when you marry that together with the objective that's very broad, I don't know how it's possible to accomplish that objective, especially the standard of known or should have known, based on what it says in paragraph 9. And I get back to that, so I think the standard is inconsistent. It holds the auditor to a high level of performance, but then says you're only supposed to do that with these limited steps. And I worry that the objective and the expectation far exceeds what we're saying they're supposed to do. And that's the primary conflict I see in the standard. You put the external auditor in a very difficult situation of holding them to a high result, but saying they have to get there by doing limited procedures. And if that comes to fore, I think the objective will win out over what paragraph 9 says.
Other comments before we leave this area? Any other comments?
Well, Craig,
Paul Biswick, SEC.
Greg, I think it would be helpful if the staff did provide some views to the questions that Vin and Jim and others have raised. Is through the release, have you redefined due professional care, or are we relying on the existing standard? And it seems to be a question that was posed, and I think it would be helpful to people who are providing comments if there is some clarification provided.
Any other comments? Okay, let's move to the last topic for discussion, with respect to the engagement quality review. Let's talk about the documentation I alluded to earlier. Under the new proposal, documentation of the engagement quality review should contain sufficient information to identify who performed the review, the documents reviewed, and significant discussions held during the review and the date that the reviewer provided concurring approval of issuance. If the reviewer did not provide concurring approval of issuance, the proposal would require documentation of the reviewer's reasons for not providing concurring approval of issuance. Final question then states, are the, before you on the slide, are the documentation requirements in the reproposed standard appropriate? If not, how should they be changed? Galen Hansen.
Paragraph 19 says, if no concurring approval of issuance is provided, the reasons for not providing the approval need to be documented. And maybe you can help me out with this, but if the review is required in order to be issued in accordance with paragraphs 12 and 13, I don't know. It seems contradictory. How can you issue the financial statements without the review, but if you don't have the review, you have to document why you didn't have the review? It just seems a little bit strange.
You're correct. I mean, obviously, Galen, that if there is no concurring approval of issuance, then the firm cannot issue the report. You're right. We thought you should, you know, just close the gap and explain what happened in the work papers can be, because the report may never be issued. No, our work papers can be archived, you know, as is. Okay, but you know, then you complete the. There may have been some discussions. I'm sure there were a lot of discussions, but the concurring partner or the engagement quality reviewer can close the gap, can close down what he or she was responsible for. Here's what happened, and then they're finished. They're complete. But you're right. You're right. There is obviously not going to be a report issued until there is a engagement quality review performed, and they concur. Jim Snur.
In looking at the documentation in 19C, which requires the reviewer to document discussions with the engagement team, significant discussions, going back to some of the comments we had earlier about Ben's comments around the process or the interaction between the reviewer and the engagement team, I don't see how, and Sam's comments earlier about what the objective is here, I don't see how the documentation improves water quality. The engagement team has already documented in the work papers their conclusions about whatever the particular either financial reporting or auditing issue was. So I see this looks more like, as Sam talked about, police, you know, a cop coming in and having to document the discussions. It doesn't seem to add to order quality, and it seems to be, I'm not sure what the purpose of it is. It's not really described as to what the purpose of that is. So I don't see any incremental benefit, and it would add a lot of, potentially add a lot of time to the process.
Jim, on the, looking at it from perspective of, let's look at the engagement team first, but doesn't documentation, audit documentation drive good audit quality?
I agree with that, but the engagement team under the auditing standards already has a requirement to document their significant conclusions. And what we're asking the reviewer to do is simply concur on those conclusions. So I don't know why the reviewer would then have to document in the detail that seems to be here that their discussions with the engagement team. I mean, there's already the overall requirement that, you know, that in terms of issuing the report, he essentially or she has to be comfortable with those conclusions before they give their approval. So an incremental documentation around, and given the number of discussions that potentially are held, I mean, if you think of a large multinational engagement, concurrent reviewer may spend hundreds of hours on that engagement. If they have to document, you know, every time they have a conversation around a significant judgment, it's unwieldy, and I don't see the benefit to the overall water quality.
Mr. Amorazzella?
I totally agree with Jim. And the only point that I will add is looking at the purpose of that, what I might envision to be the purpose of adding that requirement based on the proposing release, that requirement almost looks to me like an inspection, that requirement is focused on your inspection process. And I can appreciate that, but again, I would caution the board on writing auditing standards in order to improve their ability to inspect auditors.
Thank you, Sam. Joe Carcello?
Greg, if you forgive me, I want to go back and revisit the last discussion briefly. I'm sorry I didn't comment on it, but I needed a little bit of time to formulate my thoughts. My friends in the profession express a lot of concern about this due care issue and as it ties into know or should have known. And so maybe there's an issue there that I don't fully understand, and if there is, I'd like them to articulate it. But I guess from an investor perspective, to me, the way that standard, the proposed standard is written, is essentially it says if you review the documentation that the standard requires you to review, if you have the discussions that the standard requires you to have, using due care, which includes professional skepticism, then if there is a problem that's obvious from doing that, you either know it, but you can't know someone's state of mind, or you should have known it, which is allows for the fact that you can't know someone's state of mind. And I'll give an example of why I think this is important. I've done some expert witness work for the Securities and Exchange Commission, and in one of the cases I did, they were seriously thinking about bringing an enforcement action against the second partner, and they decided not to bring the enforcement action because the existing standard was sufficiently vague that they felt that they didn't have a strong enough legal basis to bring that action. But I would give you a concrete example. Let's assume I'm the second partner on an engagement, and in the work papers, inventory obsolescence is an issue. And so I look at the documentation, and the documentation is a client schedule of a high and low estimate of the obsolescence reserve that is X'd through with no explanation, substituted with another client schedule with a high and low estimate, which are much lower numbers than on the first schedule, and the number that's picked and that ends up in the 10K is the low number, which is the same number that was in the 10K in the previous year, where inventory had increased by a factor of 3 or 4 or 5 and had with indication that inventory was not turning over at all. To me, that would indicate that if I'm the second partner and the audit procedures that had been done were minimal, at least in terms of documentation of those audit procedures, to me that would indicate that I know, or if I didn't know, I should have known that I probably don't have sufficient appropriate audit evidence as it relates to the inventory obsolescence reserve. Because if I had used due care with professional skepticism, I would be troubled by that. So maybe there's a legal issue that the people in the firms can explain to me. But short of that, it seems to me that the PCAOB's language here is completely appropriate.
Thank you, Joe. Doug Anderson?
To go back to the other topic on documentation, I tend to agree with Jim that I see 19C as unnecessary. If you've got the paragraph 16 and you've got the recurring partner completing 19A, B, and D, I don't know what 19C adds.
Jeff Mahoney?
Thank you. I'm certainly not in support of unwieldy, unnecessary.
documentation, but you said to me a few minutes earlier that your inspection results revealed a lack of documentation so that you're unable to determine what the reviewer actually did. So I would err on the side of having more documentation, not less.
Thank you, Jeff. Hal Schroeder?
I would agree and take the opposite side of Doug. It's been a few years since I've done an audit, but when we had a concurring partner involved, we always, the audit team would write up that discussion and what the conclusions were. So all the independent partner or engagement reviewer, whatever we're calling it today, it would come in and sign off on that memo. So it would be not a tremendous burden, but went a long way in documenting what was actually done in the consultations, and that would include national office, which we haven't really, you know, touched on here. I guess that's in other people that you consult with. But I would strongly encourage you to leave C in there. I think it's highly appropriate.
Okay. Thank you, Hal. Larry Salva?
I agree that something should be included in the standard about documentation of the areas reviewed by the engagement quality reviewer, but I think 19C is too prescriptive, especially in large and complex and, you know, multinational engagements, et cetera, to say that, you know, the date of each discussion, the substance of the discussion, et cetera, it would become way too burdensome on the process, and I believe would add a lot of time without significantly enhancing quality. But I can appreciate that something should be written, similar to like what Hal just suggested, a memo or something that indicates the areas that were reviewed would be appropriate, but to be this detailed, I think, is overly prescriptive.
Randy Fletchall?
I just want to respond to Joe Carcello's observation, and I am smart enough to realize with Professor Cox and a bunch of other attorneys in the room, I'm not going to try to articulate a difference between known and should have known and due professional care. I think Jim Schnur made a very valid point that due professional care is already defined for all audit engagements for all roles, and seems redundant. Having said that, Joe, we have no objection to performing the engagement quality review in accordance with due professional care. So if it needs to be in there to reinforce, no one is really fighting that. What I think you're hearing the objection to, and I think it was laid out fairly clearly in comment letters on the original exposure, was that should know or should have known is a different standard and does have a legal connotation that we thought was not the right objective or the right standard. And so to see the board say, okay, we agree, we're going to change it and go to due professional care, which is well understood, but in the release still say, but we really think it's the same thing. It's that part of it, Joe, that we're saying we don't think it is the same thing. And whether we have legal opinions on that in our comment letters, that's the only issue I think that's really on the table, is we don't think it's the same thing. And I'm not going to be, like I said, I'm too smart to take on exactly what those differences are. But that's all we're really talking about, not that we don't want to do the engagement quality review in accordance with due professional care.
Steve Rafferty?
I'm going to switch back to this 19C issue and sort of pile on with the auditors here. I think this could be terribly cumbersome, and I suspect maybe this came from the issue that you couldn't tell where the concurring reviewers had been in the files. But I really believe 19B probably accomplishes the objective in saying the documents reviewed by the engagement quality reviewer. You have to identify where they've been in the file. And I think requiring them to then document every discussion that they have on significant issues is going to be terribly cumbersome. A lot of those significant issues are going to be in the form of consultations that are documented in terms of what the issue is, what the applicable standards are, what the firm's evaluation of that is, and it's going to be signed off by that concurring reviewer. So it's going to be pretty obvious where they've been in the file and where they've spent their time. To then take and write a second memo that says, oh, by the way, I did also discuss this with the engagement team, it seems a little overboard to me.
Thank you, Steve. Ben Coleman?
Perhaps 2 points. Just one final point on in response to Joe's question by Randy. I think Paul Beswick was kind of asking the question. Is this a standard of performance or a standard of enforcement? And I think we're getting it confused, and I'd sure like to understand that, because I think that's where you just went, Joe. And I think we got to, you know, if we're going to talk about it, I mean, candidly, that's kind of where you'd have to go, right? Because we all know what due professional care is. We want to exhibit due professional care. So I think there's no debate around that. But when you start redefining what due professional care is, as Jim said, when there's a whole standard there, and then in a couple words redefine it for enforcement reasons, I think it starts getting confused. These are supposed to be standards of performance. Enforcement, let's decide how you handle that and handle that in a different manner, at least as it relates to how we would have people action a standard in our firm. And then moving to 19C, again, just being somebody in the room who is a concurring partner on a very, very large organization, when it says including the date of each discussion, I would just ask that you think through these words, and if you've ever kind of tested it in a real-life engagement, I think that you would see the cost-benefit would be incredibly difficult if you really understand the number of interactions that go on, you know, during the course of a year, if you're doing, if you're satisfying all the other paragraphs of this standard.
Wayne Collins.
On that 19C, it looks like it's almost combining a couple of things. I can see having that standard, and there is a standard in there already for consultations during an engagement where you consult with somebody in the National Accounting Department or whatever it happens to be, and you have a significant issue that you consult on, you document that. That's fine. These kinds of discussions that happen on an engagement are at various levels, various gradations from the a very insignificant issue to very significant issues. And the ultimate resolution of those discussions are hopefully embedded in the work papers, and the work papers should indicate whether the concurring reviewer, engagement quality reviewer, reviewed those work papers. So I think that that ultimate resolution is already in the other parts of 19, and you don't need 19C for that reason.
Thank you, Wayne. Sharon Feierstein.
Wayne, I actually have to disagree with you. I think that actually, if you just look at 19A, B, and D, it doesn't really get the whole flavor of what was done in that concurring review process. And while I agree that 19C is certainly overly prescriptive and there really won't be enough of a cost-benefit there, I mean, it's just the benefit will clearly not outweigh the cost of it, I think that there does need to be some type of summary describing what has gone on during that process, because frankly, telling me who did it and when they did it isn't really enough to tell me what was really happening in that process.
Galen Hansen? Galen? House Schroeder? Sorry.
I do see a definite difference between B and C. You can look at whole sections of an audit that have no major issues, but you still thought appropriate as a concurring partner to sign off on those documents or at least gain an understanding. And I've heard a couple times, well, that would be two memos in the file on an issue, and I would think that there would only be the one that the team wrote that talks about how the engagement or the concurring partner was involved in that process. And I'm still focusing on the word significant. I would assume that, and I've heard several people, well, they'd have to document every discussion. I think we're carrying it too far. It would be only those things that are significant. The team would document, and then concurring partner's responsibility to go and sign off on those memos. Presumably, they'd be in some order for it to be not in a very burdensome process. So I see B and C as different things, and I think it's the only way to close the loop and finalize what actually happened on the engagement.
Jim Cox?
Yeah, I sort of feel the same way, Harold, that I think the point, and it may not be adequately well, I mean, it may not be well expressed in 19C, but I think the point is to communicate the level of intensity of the review that was carried out, quality review. And that is best communicated, I think, by identifying the areas where there was some evidence of drilling down. You know, we can think about this lots of other ways of handling it, but we all live by time logs, even academics, by the way. And so we may want to keep track of that and know that you've allocated a significant amount of time to a particular engagement and a particular inquiry. But I think the key point here is significant, and perhaps you'd like to flesh it out, but I think what the real issue here is so that if a third party, such as the PCAOB, comes in and reviews the quality of the quality reviews, they have some evidence of the intensity of the review that occurred. And if you don't have that, then I don't think 19A, B, and D get you there.
Thank you, Jim. Any other comments on documentation or any other part? Jamie Miller?
I just want to comment on this one as well. You know, I agree with the overall objective of requiring documentation for the review and that, you know, covering both the significant matters discussed and the nature of the documents reviewed. But, you know, I have to say from a cost-benefit perspective, I completely agree with the discussion we've had. I think, you know, as a practical matter, when you are dealing with very, very large engagements where the review can take hundreds, sometimes even thousands of hours, I think the level of the prescriptive words you have here may not be practicable. And so what I hear today is nobody's disagreeing with the intent of what's being written. It's the way it's written and the actual specific requirement that's articulated in C. So maybe that could be shortened and moved to a more objectives-based language.
Jim Cox?
Yeah, I think that may be the wording suggestion, is that you want to avoid sort of ironclad wording, but you'd like to communicate again what your objective is, and you'd like to have sufficient records or documentation so that if should there ever be a third-party review, that one can make a judgment or the records are adequate to feel comfortable with the level of intensity that was appropriate given the challenges of the review.
Any more comments on documentation or any other aspect of the engagement quality review that we've discussed today? Gary? Yes.
I have one on a subject we haven't discussed if you're moving to a general discussion. I'm actually up on question one where you're talking about the types of engagements. You got an audit and you got the interim reviews and it's a general statement. I would agree those are the ones you need to do, and a lot of other, you know, agreed upon procedures or a long form report for some due diligence. Those aren't necessary. But did you consider requiring any engagement quality review for SAS 70 reports being out there? I'm thinking particularly SAS 70 type 2, thinking for our own, you know, SOX procedures. I mean, there's a lot of stuff is outsourced to vendors and information providers and so on, and that's sort of the where the world is going these days, more and more outsourcing, more and more offshore soaring the specialists. So I found over the 5 years we've been doing the 404 work, we actually have more SAS 70 reports now than we did in year one because it's just normal evolution of the business. The question is, should you require an engagement quality review for a SAS 70 report that you're issuing? Did you consider it? My instincts tell me it's probably a good thing. I don't know if it's a great thing, and I don't even know if I'd hold up finalizing this and deal it separately, but was it considered, and listen for reaction to anybody else?
We certainly would appreciate your comments, Gary, and any others that any type of report that we should consider that should be subject to an engagement quality review, and we would like to have that in a comment letter. And if there's anything else, Gary, or anyone else, any other item that we should consider, including, please let us know. Let us know now or in a comment letter. Let us know if there's anything else we should consider. Yes, Galen Hansen.
I happen to agree that the SAS 70 and you can't really rely on a type 1 but a type 2. We're seeing more and more of those in practice, and you know, the reliance on those are significantly increasing in quantity and volume. So
reliance on information service providers, I think, is going to be part of where this profession is going. And I would look forward rather than go through this standard and leave it out, but maybe consider pulling that into the standard.
Thank you, Galen. Any other comments? Okay. Well, I thank you for your input, and I want to remind you that the comment period ends on April 20th, and I encourage you to write comment letters. Anything you mentioned today or anything you want to comment on in the release, I encourage you to get those letters into us. As you can see, you can see from this reproposal the impact that those comment letters had on the staff and the board, and we certainly appreciate your input. And I'll turn the meeting over to Jennifer Rand.
Thanks, Greg, and thanks again for your input in connection with that discussion. We're a little bit ahead of schedule, which in my view is absolutely fine. So we'll just go ahead and move to break. We'll take a 30-minute break as we had planned, but we'll adjourn at 10:45.